Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I have two really, really smart, wonderful guys whose vibe I just love, their approach to the world, their approach to the gospel, and I thought I would put them both on the same show and just, like, let's just sit and listen to deep thinkers share about something that's really important. We are going to focus on faith crisis and somehow that how that leads often to unbelief versus belief and kind of some of the obstacles to believing. But one of the things that we want to do tonight is also problematize, you know, that move as well. So when we know that it's hard to believe and there's obstacles to belief, but there should be some reminders to us as well when we go into unbelief that somehow we're probably not getting the full picture and the full richness there as well. So that's the basic subject matter, but how this goes with these two extraordinary guys, we will just see. So the first one let me introduce you to is somebody who's returning to the podcast, Phil Barlow. You've been on a couple of times. Welcome back. Would you quickly remind everybody a little bit about your background, what you're doing now, and those sorts of things?
Well, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me, and glad to be on here with Carlisle, whom I've admired from afar for many years. I went off to study religion academically, left Utah back several decades ago to go back east and think about religion formally. Thought I would study everything but Mormonism, essentially, because I was under the sweet impression that I understood my own faith and had cause to rethink that along the way and keep thinking as I studied American religious history and culture for a number of years, and did that eventually through a doctoral program. And then I taught at the University of Rochester in New York for a couple of years, and for 17 years back at a wonderful private liberal arts college, Hanover College, on the Ohio River. And 7 or 8 years ago came out to Utah State University to help found the religious studies program here in which students can major.
And you're actually in the endowed chair, the Leonard Arrington Chair for, is it Chair for Mormon Studies? Is that the name of it?
The Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture.
Mormon History and Culture, yeah. But you also, besides teaching Mormon classes at Utah State, you're just teaching more broad religion classes as well?
Yes, they brought me here to make sure I addressed Mormon themes. But I teach about a whole range of things. I teach about American religion, and I teach about religion and human suffering and religious responses to it, or religion and the concept of time, or religion and silence. So it ranges a bit.
Nice, nice. And then you're on sabbatical right now. Are you willing to share what book you're working on while you're doing this?
I am Skyping in the last few months, Jan Shipps and I, who are writing a book together, Skype every morning, and we are working on a book for Columbia University Press as part of their series on contemporary religion in America. But we are going out of our way to have it be not a generic introduction to Mormonism. We have several good versions of those as well as other kinds. But we are looking at things from some unconventional angles of vision. Like right now I'm attempting the first ethnographic study of Mormons and Salt Lake culture and global culture of General Conference. For instance, I'm arguing this isn't just about what is said or said even over time in General Conference by the authorities of the church, but rather I'm arguing that Mormonism doesn't have a single center. It has a cluster of centers like the family or the ward or the temple or the atonement, or it's construed many times, or even geographically, the Mountain West or Utah or Salt Lake City. I'm arguing that General Conference functions as a kind of an epicenter to many Mormon impulses and social patterns and patterns of establishing what is construed as orthodox and not, that sort of thing. So I'm having fun trying my hand at that.
Woohoo! And that's just one of many chapters.
Right.
Awesome. Well, welcome to the show again. Thank you so much for being on. We'll always love having you. Carlisle, he mentioned you, and this is Carlisle Hunsaker is our other guest today. Carlisle is just, I got to know him a bit through the Sunstone years when I hosted events and just came to really appreciate his deep wisdom. And I'm going to even kind of label you one of our leading mystics in Mormonism. Is that where
we're
out to you, brother?
No, that's a first.
Well, it's more of a, well, it's a definitely a contemplative spirituality. Let's put it that way. Would that be?
Okay, now you're getting a little better.
A little warmer. Well, anyway, would you quickly tell everybody your fun background and what you're up to today?
Sure, I'll be glad to. And thanks, Dan. Thanks for the invitation. I've followed your work and admired it and enjoyed it very much. And Phil, I've had a chance to be aware of your writing and your work, and that's been a great contribution to so many people. So for about 25 years, I taught in the CES program of the church. 22 of those years were at the Institute of Religion, adjacent to the University of Utah, the Salt Lake Institute of Religion. Those were wonderful Camelot years, full of positive relationships with students and colleagues alike.
Were you there during the Lowell Bending years?
I got there the year after Lowell left.
Okay.
And but Lowell became a real mentor and friend over the years. What a wonderful opportunity it was to get better acquainted with him and his work.
Neat.
So I wanted just to have you understand something about those years and why I left. I was 25 years with CES, and as I mentioned, 22 years of those spent at the Institute of Religion at Salt Lake. In those days, I was convinced, really, that to step into a classroom, or for that matter, any environment set apart for teaching and learning, is to step on holy ground, and that conviction has really never diminished over those years. In 1986 or 87, I left the Institute, and that was a difficult and even wrenching decision for the reasons that I've expressed. But that was the beginning. At that point in time, the Institute program mandated a kind of a change in the teaching of the courses in the Institute, and it was a manualizing process. Follow the manual, at least that's the way I experienced the changes that were being mandated. And frankly, it felt like I was being asked to teach with a gun at my temple. And so I left, and the brethren who initiated those changes, some of them were general authorities, some were CES administrators working under the direction of general authorities. But these were all good and devoted men. It just got to the point where we were kind of working across purposes. At that point in time, when I left the Institute, that also marked the beginning of an explosion of research having to do with brain science and mindfulness. I'd been interested in all of this just prior to my departure from CES, and so I pursued that interest, worked a bit with some of the folks who were on the wavefront of that movement, and eventually found myself at Tosh, the orthopedic specialty hospital in Murray, teaching mindfulness to patients and to colleagues. And so I did that for 25 years. So once again, there I was on holy ground until I retired about a year and a half ago. And currently I'm still seeing folks in a private office here in Salt Lake.
Neat. What a fun dual career. Two halves to it. But it sounds like what you did in the second half were things that you were already at least centered in that first half of your career before the curriculum change.
Yes, I started to snoop around at that in maybe 3 or 4 years before all of that happened.
It's wonderful to have you. And for listeners who may remember a few podcasts ago, I talked a little bit about the tragic gap and used Parker Palmer's language, but I also pointed everybody towards one of Carlyle's wonderful pieces called Mormonism and the Tragic Sense of Life. And that was published many, many years ago in Sunstone and then republished in the last year and a half or so. And it's one of the classic essays in Mormonism that I'll point to you again here on the website today. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Phil, I'm going to start with you, if you will, a little bit for our discussion, let you kind of lead out. We know that there's a lot of people that when their minds become troubled about religion, they discover various things or whatnot, they kind of get disillusioned, they get angry, they experience some pain, they feel like they can't, you know, honestly question in those places that they used to feel at home with, you know, right there in church meetings itself, or sometimes with families or close circles and things like this. And sometimes it kind of poisons them to religion in general and not just Mormonism. And I for me, a lot of them will say, well, I want something that I won't be deceived at. And so they'll move into science or just a kind of rejection mode of religion and things. And I'd love you just to kind of frame for us what you see going on in that move. Go ahead and reiterate anything that I just said and, you know, expand on it. But also then I'd love you just to kind of lead us into a beginning discussion of is this move to non-belief or rejection of religion, you know, really that clear-eyed a move or a clear, you know, yeah. There, I know there's things going on there that we all would say, hold on, it's not that innocent a move. So I'll just leave it at that poor framing, but I know you'll bring it home for us.
Well, there's naturally 100 ways to go with a topic so rich as what seems to be stirring in Mormonism, and I do think there's a real stirring in the church and in the Mormon movement, including a kind of a rapidly spreading crucible of doubt, as Terrell and Fiona Givens put it, a crisis of faith, if you will. There is a high church leader or two whom I respect very much, but who don't believe that there is such a crisis, and they cite statistics and the absence of statistics about church members removing their names and formally leaving that way as evidence that we're wrong. The common chatter around the culture about there being a kind of crisis of faith. So I don't think that the measurement of people removing their names formally from the church is a very good measure of what's going on. The overwhelming majority of people, when their faith is broken or submerged or suspended or just grappled with, they're not largely removing their names from the church. They're just getting angry and quit going to church sometimes, or keep going and flying under the radar with their doubts, whatever they're doing. So that could be a whole conversation podcast by itself, the causes and the attempt to characterize what's going on. But I personally have no doubts, because I'm dealing with it every day and every week with people struggling or angry or various attitudes. So there's plenty of things one could be angry about or ask questions about or have doubt about legitimately. So I'm certainly not suggesting that doubts or questions are bad. Indeed, I think they're essential for an adult human being to ask. But I do think there's as much irrationality or ill-informed assumptions on the part of people who gain an entrenched faith that the church is wrong or fraudulent as there is among believers who may be uncritical in their faith and not informed about history or philosophy, or since we have the person who is the church's greatest mystic who denies the title with us, Carla, mindfulness and various states of thoughtfulness or lack of thoughtfulness range all over the place. That is not a believer's problem merely. It is a human problem, and there's plenty of it on all sides. But we don't talk nearly so much about the psychology of unbelief. People who are struggling with faith or standing outside it, or sometimes even articulating a reason for their belief or talking about states of mind in relation to their faith or their former faith. But we don't as often really probe thoughtfully states of mind that lead away from the church. And so you invited me here partly because I gave a talk in that down in Salt Lake City a few months ago at your indirect invitation, I understand.
Yes.
And called it the psychology of belief. So maybe we could start with the two controlling points I made there, and I could spread them out a little bit if I have your permission to go that direction, and then Carlisle and you and I can pull it apart like cookie dough or junk it and go any other direction.
Great. No, I was hoping that you would choose to go that way. So keep a framing for us. Thank you, brother.
Well, I structured that talk around two general points. And the first one is a gesture towards some common or foundational roots of unbelief in Western civilization in recent centuries, and try to relate that a little bit to some examples that go on within the LDS tradition. And the second half of the structure is to suggest that virtue is an epistemic lens. That is to say, we approach truth or have a sense of truth or our faith commitments to some or another proposition or sensibility. For shorthand, I'll call that the gospel, by which I'll mean Mormon sensibilities and understandings of the gospel, but I know that all those terms could use unpacking. So our character and our attitude, individual traits and as a whole, have an epistemic character to them. That's a fancy philosopher's word, comes from a Greek word that means knowledge. So epistemology for non-philosophers means how we know what we know, or more properly, the study within philosophy of how we know what we think we know. And so my suggestion here is that our character, even our mood for that matter, has an epistemic quality to it. It actually is coloring the lens through which we see or think we see or sense or hear reality, when we're often, or not only often, but maybe inevitably, at least partially, encountering the lens rather than reality as such. Did I make that sense?
Yeah, wonderful.
So Phil, the character part would be to be able to stand apart, in a manner of speaking, from the lens and realize what's on the lens and try to not accommodate that more than I do reality?
Well, it could take that tack, and I'll talk a little bit after I lay out part one. I'll get to that part two a little more fully, but thank you for helping me clarify. It could go that direction, or we at least could have a conversation about it, but it is rather, I'm not sure, you're a mindfulness expert, and so there are all sorts of mindfulness traditions, some of which consider themselves religious and others less so, Buddhism, Christian mysticism, any number of them. Try to empty the mind. And so there are arguments or plenty of believers who believe that that is possible. I myself am not positive that we can wholly separate ourselves from an epistemic lens that comes from our being humans of a certain character. So we can have a talk about that later and explore that together, and maybe I can learn from you as well as us have a trialogue about it. But it is to argue that, Richard, I think when I was a late teenager, I first read an essay by Richard Bushman, who was talking about faithful history in a dialogue article early. And he talked about the relation of faith to doing history, and he ended it in a way that has struck me ever since, and maybe even relevant to what made me eventually think about this at some length. He quoted Joseph Smith's famous assertion, or revealed assertion even, that a man, meaning humans, I'm sure, a man is saved no faster than he gains knowledge. Knowledge is essential to salvation. And Bushman, as can be done epigrammatically, so often inverted that thought to create a corollary related but not exactly parallel insight. He said, his last line, as I remember in this essay, was, "A man gains knowledge no faster than he is saved." And I take him to be meaning something like I'm suggesting, that character and attitude affect what you see, what you take in as reality.
Indeed.
Yeah, love it.
So we can go back to that. Just,
that'll be rich.
Just briefly on some roots of unbelief classically, or is that more than we want to try to do in one night here?
Let's lay it out there. Let's name it. Let's put some Freud and Marx and those guys out there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just name a few like that, and then go in to one example a little bit more in depth, and then we can talk about virtue as an epistemic lens. Within Mormonism and the crisis that's going on right now, it's a very common sentiment to feel and thought to think that the church has betrayed me. And what people seem to mean is that, like I'm always still startled, it's hard for me to get used to the idea when I'm teaching classes at a university campus up here in Logan and find, if we're teaching about Joseph Smith, that some people don't know that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, that they actually get introduced to that idea for the first time in a class sometimes, maybe less so than 5 or 10 years ago with all this crisis in the air, but it still happens. And when they learn things like that that shock them, then the question is naturally, why wasn't I taught this earlier, and what else did they fail to teach me? And they lose confidence and go exploring all the other things that they didn't know, often from sources that are informed, but often from sources that are not informed, that are have just had this experience and they're sharing it by way of contagion with other people. But I won't go into depth there because that's not the point of our immediate talk, but that's understandable, and it's certainly true that the church has had a problem historically about how to teach faith and to do it in an informed and thoroughgoing way. One concern that they've had that I can respect but not agree with the solution that has always been proposed is that we're a lay church and we have lay teachers, and that exists for some very important reasons. And when they're teaching, they can often get lost in thickets of speculation or metaphysics that they're not equipped for, and certainly that their audience may not be equipped for. And so we're so concerned that we might get off track that way, that we don't fall off a cliff that way, that we run into granite cliffs on the other side. And one example of that is what Carlyle was alluding to that induced him to leave the CES, and that is an overly correlated, overly color by dots, sort of a teaching emphasis that could suffocate thinking for adult people and real probing and growth. So it's, but I don't think it's that the church intentionally betrays for the most part, but rather hasn't known how to go about it and are praying and struggling and deciding in the course of history how to do it. So, Dan, you were up in Logan last night, and we touched on this topic just in the hallway of the church, and that is Moroni 10 has somewhere along the line in the last 80 or 100 years become the predominant model for Mormon faith. You know, the gospel is true because you know the Book of Mormon is true, and you know the Book of Mormon is true because Moroni 10 offers you a promise that the Holy Ghost will make that clear to you if you pray earnestly and with real intent, having faith in Christ. And the problem is that many people read the Book of Mormon several times and are as earnest and prayerful as they know how to be, and that doesn't happen for them.
Right.
So they may lose faith on a misunderstanding on our part as a group, and maybe on their part as individuals, that Moroni 10 is only one path among many that Joseph Smith alluded to, that the scriptures allude to, that many Mormons and Mormon leaders have testified of, like by their fruits you shall know them, Jesus says, or Alma 32, perform an experiment on my words, and Joseph talks about being able to taste the doctrine. So it's not that the church, on an example like that, is trying to betray anyone. It's just that the church is full of people like you and me who flow in history and think in currents of thought and sometimes ask questions about them, but there's no conscious betrayal going on. It's just a historical development. Similarly, why did the church deceive us? One young person asked me recently, why did the church lie to us about the way that Joseph translated the plates? I can go right down to the chapel right now and show you. He said to me, Joseph, translating the plates like he's studying the plates, and then he's writing or dictating right from the plates, whereas it seems that the evidence suggests that the plates weren't crucial as such in the process of translation. And again, I don't think that's the church consciously betraying anyone. The people who painted that painting and put it all over as posters in the church assumed that's the way it was. It's not a conscious sense of sneaky betrayal. So those are examples that way. More classically and broadly in the history of Western civilization, we have, as you said, Dan, Freud diagnosed religion as a form of neurosis, a form of wish fulfillment. We need a sacred canopy over our heads to say there is order and there is safety and there is God in charge at the helm. So it's kind of a giant thumb-sucking exercise. Or Marx famously wrote a lot that no one else reads, but they remember that religion is the opiate of the people, that he said once in one passage, meaning that religion makes people pay attention to a pie in the sky and an eventual afterlife without worrying about social justice and decent living and equity here on the planet Earth. Or there's the so-called new atheists who argue that religion, especially Christianity and Islam, produce fanatics. And even moderate religions are based on superstitions which lay the ground for fanatics. And maybe the backbone of disbelief across the centuries has been the problem of radical, inexplicable human suffering, or suffering so horrific that attempts to explain it are obscene in their absurdity and inadequacy. Or that science is the only way only epistemic path that we have to be secure with, or that there's so many diverse religions that their various diversity disproves each other. They can't all be true, and therefore they're all false. So I don't know if I should go into wish fulfillment or some example of that a little more deeply, given the time we have and that we want a lot more Carlyle than we're having so far. Maybe I should leave it at that to say those are examples of problems that lead people into unbelief among very thoughtful people. But in popular hands, they can go all which way and oftentimes not be very informed. And I think that's a problem, and I think that's sad and causes great agonies and writhings of spirit when those assertions by those thinkers haven't been probed as thoroughly as they might be.
Yeah. Carlyle, what's your reaction so far to any areas that Phil's mentioned that you would say, let me weigh in right now?
Yeah, I'm interested in the psychology of disbelief, and I enjoyed reading the rough draft of Phil's setup for a kind of thought experiment, I think, with a group here in Salt Lake City around that issue. And it was that he said, let us regard, for purposes of discussion, that Joseph Smith, by whatever means, produced a gospel, a church, which is a blessing, or in that sense, true, if you will. And then try to figure out, given that it is a blessing and that it's true, try to figure out what's really happening with folks who find it difficult to accept that which is a blessing and true. So I would think that if indeed I see it as a blessing and true, would it not evoke my belief and commitment? But if it does not, then why? Perhaps on some level, we are at that gut-wrenching kind of quandary wherein that which we see as a blessing prevents me from obtaining something that seems compellingly important. So if that is the case, in order to avoid a kind of cognitive dissonance, maybe I need to work at punching holes in the blessing. And the flip side of that, I think, it works the same way. If we view the gospel as a force which can or does empower us to obtain something we view as compellingly attractive, then the tendency would be to embrace the gospel, perhaps even to the extent of ignoring some problems and difficulties in our church experience. So I have a kind of thought experiment of my own. Let me just put it out there and we can maybe work with it. So let's suppose that we agree that to any of us, all of us, require an ultimate or guiding value in order to enjoy clarity in our lives as to how best to manage all of the other value choices that we face. And let us suppose that life at its highest pitch is that guiding value. Call it joy, call it fulfillment, call it the abundant life, whatever term works for you. But here's where this kind of process tends to break down. Joy or happiness, these are abstractions. And the last time I checked, abstractions cannot guide my life. So here's the question. What must one have and or experience if one is to experience the living of one's life as being deeply fulfilling? So for purposes of discussion, what could be a kind of short list of the components of human fulfillment? Just leaving concerns for specific church gospel issues to the side for a moment, what's a short list? I just want to throw out four or five specific components of what I regard to be key to a fulfilling life: a sense of personal dignity, autonomy, one's activities and pursuits freely chosen, intrinsically meaningful, experienced as being significant, enjoying the process of doing what I do, positive relatedness, no submission, no coerciveness, compassion, those kinds of things. So that short list serves me well. So let me just throw out my point and my question. So if what is there that I could point to in my experience of the gospel or the church, the institutional or conceptual aspects of Mormonism, that would work against the grain of those qualities of experience that I just put out there? What would come to mind? And I'm wondering, with folks who say, in one sense, I love the church, I love the gospel, but somehow it isn't working for me, if they're not trying to talk about what I'm suggesting here, that there's something about the way I'm experiencing my church life that does indeed discourage or run against the grain of these components of human fulfillment.
Yeah, and so they may say, they may put it in phrases, I don't believe this teaching, this something, but more at a more deeper level, they're saying, I'm not finding an autonomous space for me. I'm not finding that I'm having significant experiences. I'm not enjoying the processes. But they're probably naming it something else and not realizing these deeper things. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, again, going back to what I understood Phil's thought experiment to be, remember, we're working on the premise that I do sense that the church is a blessing, and in that sense, true. So what's the problem I'm having?
Yeah.
It must be that my engagement with the church isn't working in harmony with or contributing to what I'm calling the components of human fulfillment. So what could be some of the specific dimensions of my way of experiencing the institution, my engagement with the institutional aspect of Mormonism? And what are some of the conceptual components of our faith that could work against the grain? Our view of God, for example, Joseph Smith wants to remind us that the first principle of the gospel is indeed to know for a certainty the true character of God. Well, I think I can understand how some views of him, God, and how he relates to us could run against the grain of autonomy, could run against the grain of intrinsic motivation, could run against the grain of this is important for its own sake rather than I need to do this in order to get some kind of extrinsic payoff.
I love where you're headed here. Can I like do a little directing traffic here or something like that? So what I'm hearing here is Phil talks about there's all these different things going on that will lead somebody to maybe choose disbelief over belief if they can't assert the goodness of Mormonism or something. They may say, oh, I'll look at Freud, I'll look at Marx, I'll look at the Sam Harris and all those kinds of different things, and they won't really interrogate that because of this film. And now you're helping us just to sort of see there's all these things that really do make for a fulfilling life that they're not matching. And so what I see at least going on, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're both at least playing in the area of these deeper seated things are happening, and I'm kind of naming them one way, but they're probably at this, at least for you, Carlisle, they're at this level of I'm not feeling like I can act with the right amount of autonomy. I don't feel like my personal dignity is being honored here or something. And they're not saying that, most likely, or some obviously are. We're hearing very articulate voices in these areas too. But often I think we just start talking about belief, 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 and we're looking for ways to poke holes in beliefs in order to kind of explain why we're not feeling these other things. Is that close?
Yes. So again, my thought was that if this blessing, using Phil's good word, called the church, source of blessing, source of truth, doesn't do it for me, meaning to give me this sense of life at its highest pitch, then I either have to say I'm at fault, or where else do I go? Something wrong with the church.
Right, so then you head towards that, and you think you're making a purely rational move when you're making a move that's got a lot of currents and a lot of energies that are kind of steering you that way, right?
Many of them are implicit.
Right, exactly. Phil, what do you think? Are you guys somewhat in the same ballpark?
Yeah, I really like that thought, as long as we remember that we are doing thought experiments and approaches to a problem, which is essential really for making our way, since there's a lot of ways to think. And so I love Carlyle's whole process of positing a thought experiment and saying asking where this would take us. So that might link a little bit. You can help us decide if there's a link there or if it's artifice, Dan. But
what if we did this for just a moment? Because we've both kind of been around the block with this sort of issue with a lot of different folks. So when we're talking to someone who has had a background in the church, maybe had a period of time in the church when they were deeply involved and loved it, and then all at once this isn't working and so on. And so if you look at these components of human fulfillment, I think they apply to any human being I know, across age gaps, across gender gaps, across ethnic gaps, because I think they represent needs of the human spirit. So what might be happening in the church, in their experience of the church, that would deny them, or that would again work against the grain of this short list of the components of human fulfillment that I'm proposing? Would it be their experience of authority? Could it be their view of God as it has been taught? Could it be a misunderstanding of the atonement? Could it be something that has gone wrong with their sense of justice in the church? What could it be? What are some of the problems that could work against the grain of these components of human fulfillment? This might sound a little removed
Yes.
from a theological discussion or a discussion of the church, but all I'm proposing is, folks, this is all about life. The gospel is about life, and at its best, but we tend to leave what is that in the abstract. We tend not to get a handle on that, and so I think we lose our sense of how best to engage myself in the gospel and the church, and frankly, how best to interpret some aspects of our theology, which I think really properly interpreted, my bias, could be very supportive of all of these components of fulfillment.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Yeah. But it's hard. It's hard to remember those sometimes when we're in correlated material or when we don't feel the freedom to speak up and things. Yes.
I think it goes beyond that. I think it isn't that we've forgotten. I think it is that we've never tried to figure it out. What does that abstraction mean? And I need to have clarity about that to help me as I approach my engagement in the church. And if we could all kind of decide that, oh yeah, this is what we're after. We all say that we're after life. We're after Christ's abundant life, but I'm not sure that we have clarity about what it is and what contributes to it. As I think about the concept of God, there's so many things that folks hear about him, how he views us, how he relates to us, that are anything but moving me in the direction of autonomy, moving me in the direction of a sense of personal dignity. Because if he is the eye in the sky, rewarder, punisher, then all of these components are gone. So I think we could make the case that so much of conventional religion, in fact, works against human fulfillment, if we begin to try and define what that means.
That's rich. That's a rich area to play in. Phil, what would be a reaction to that that either connects with what else you wanted to talk about tonight or just or dives deeper?
Yeah, I don't know if it dives deeper than Carlyle's deep diving, but one of the things I was thinking about as you spoke, Carlyle, is the concept of love. I always think the trickiest words in a given language are those monosyllables like is or be, love or God or faith. It's some decompression and probing, and that our presumptions can get in the way in just the way that you're thinking, or at least as I'm hearing you. So, for instance, Joseph Smith's very famous passage that he has God say to Moses in Revelation when Joseph is just a young man, scarcely more than 25 or 6, is Moses 1:39, which tells us what God does when God gets out of bed in the morning. This is what I do.
Job
this is my work, my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life. And we interpret eternal life as a more godly life. So,
To break in there, that's part of my point. That tends to be where we end that lesson. Eternal life is God's life, and I want for us to think more carefully, us meaning the church, all of us, me certainly, about what is that? What are the components of the godly life? That's the same question for me as right. What are the components of human fulfillment?
And, yeah,
go ahead.
No, you weren't quite finished.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, that was going to be quite to my point, so I think I agree with you that then we have to get into the question of what that looks like. What do we mean by eternal life? And I think one place it should take us is, or should not take us, is beating our breasts like theological Tarzan and saying, I'm going to have my own planet. But rather, the best definitions I know of for the phenomenon and discipline of love, one of them is characterized so beautifully, as we all know, in Paul's narrative that we call 1 Corinthians 13, where he gives it a number of traits. And one is a psychiatric definition that I've augmented a little bit for my own purposes, that the psychiatrist Scott Peck chiseled together, and that is that love is, how does he put it, the will, so it's a form of work and courage, the will to extend oneself for the purposes of another's spiritual growth, and I add, or well-being, because I can love my mother who's in a coma, perhaps, for instance. And there's a very careful series of thoughts behind the chiseled definition. So his argument is that love is not a feeling or an emotion. That's being in love or something that we use the word love, but it's not the same as what he's arguing about, nor would it make sense with Christ's notion of love your enemies, etc. So it's a workful thing, it's an effortful, conscious thing that militates towards lifting others and helping their spiritual growth. In a Mormon context, that means spiritual and intellectual growth. And that comes pretty close to what Moses 1 and 39 drives at. A godly life, a godly life is a loving life, not romantically or sentimentally defined, but psychiatrically, spiritually defined as a building up of others sort of a life.
Yeah. So that therein lies the challenge. How do I understand that godly life on Monday morning? And so if I can approach Monday morning with a sense of something to create, something to learn, someone to nurture, something to savor, and to proceed to do all of that with full engagement, I think I'm living the godly life.
Nice.
So again, what's happening in the church when it does happen that tends to make this difficult for folks? We're busy doing our church chores, and we wouldn't speak against those. I'm going to do my home teaching. I'm going to attend my meetings. I'm going to pay my tithing and all of that, hopefully with gusto and with intrinsic meaning. But that's the church. And how do I get encouraged by the church, by the institution, by the conceptual basis of our faith, to enter Monday morning with that sense of delight, that sense that I'm entering an arena of creating and learning and nurturing and savoring, and all of that comes from I was really encouraged to remember that by what I experienced Sunday in my meetings. I think I'd like that to happen more often than it does.
For sure. And I guess now tying back, I want to make sure that the two halves of this kind of touch base, and this maybe, you know, takes it a notch less profound. I don't know. I don't want to kind of degrade this. But you're saying this is what our souls need. This is what naturally they crave. We're not getting it. We're not sure exactly why. And therefore, we move into, I therefore don't believe it, or I now emphasize the cracks that are so obviously there in the Mormon story, Mormon history, Mormon practice, the lack of compassion, the lack of justice, etc.
Yeah, I could be loving the church based on my childhood upbringing and have warm feelings about some of its teachings as best I understand them, but still this other step where, this connection between what is unique in our theology and my growing ability to walk into Monday morning in the way that I'm suggesting.
Yeah. Phil, take us into what you teased as your second half. The thing that there's so many things that are not about belief that affects belief or affects our desire to want to continue walking, you know, more or less closely with Mormonism. I think we can kind of, you know, jump in from that angle now.
I do think this can tie with a whole lot of Carlyle's stream of thought, and it does seem just a fabulously rich terrain and method. We as a church, seems to me, I as a person and we as a church could gain a great deal by Carlyle's thought experiment and asking those questions that he, I think, asks us at points rhetorically and provocatively, like how are we going to answer that? And having lessons, discussions about that churchwide could be a very good thing. The line of thought that I was on before we started that stream was, again, this part that our character traits have affect the lens through which we see and sense and hear the reality that we suppose that we're responding to.
Which is, that to me is the nexus that unites you guys. But yeah, it does have a qualitatively different feel, but that's still the nexus of tonight's discussion. So that's partly why I brought you guys together. So dive in with all.
Well, so love isn't just a constructive thing, as I defined it, or a nice thing, because we like people who act lovingly more than we like grouchy, non-loving people, haters, terrorists. But love, in addition to those facts, has epistemological dimensions to it. That's how we see things.
Yes.
Gratitude, the way I put gratitude to myself is that I'm smarter when I'm grateful. The way I experience that, or my chain of experience and reasoning, is that when I'm grateful, I'm full of great, which is to say full of grace, comes from the same root, which is to say that I'm more conscious of the grace of all things, the giftedness of life, the fact that I'm a contingent being. I'm not here of my own accord, and as the Book of Mormon suggests, every breath I take I owe to higher forces. And when I am more conscious of the grace of everything, the giftedness of all life, then where I naturally go is that I don't take things nearly so for granted. So I begin noticing roundness or air or my capacity to walk as an act of joy. The magical thing that happens when I thrust my right arm outward because I think I'm thirsty and want that cup. I take another human being or all aspects of myself less for granted, and it takes me into a higher state of awareness, a higher state of mindfulness, if it's done well and with discipline. And so that's what I mean by gratitude has an epistemological character to it. Or when Paul, just to give one more example, when our own 13th article of faith says we follow the admonition of Paul, we believe all things, we hope all things, we've endured many things and hope to be able to endure all things. When I was a younger man, I thought, not so much. I don't want to endure all things, and I don't know if there's any virtue to believing all things. What the heck? But when he says the admonition of Paul, he is calling on the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians again. So the context for what he's borrowing explicitly from Paul is love. Love bears all things. Love hopes all things. Love believeth all things. And what can that possibly mean? But it does, in the wider characterization of what we're talking about with the concept of love, Paul suggests that love endures sickness and health, inconvenience. Love is patient and suffereth long, etc.
Phil, could I break in just a minute? So when we're speaking about love, charity, Christ-like love, is that, do I blow on my hands and grit my teeth and love, or is the kind of love, mature love you're talking about, does it require a secure base from which I can finally reach out lovingly because I have the mental and emotional, spiritual elbow room to be aware of someone other than myself? So again, can I be fully loving without experiencing this deep fulfillment that we're talking about, these components of human fulfillment? Or would we take the position that love in and of itself is powerful enough, I better set about to do that, and then some of this other stuff will follow? I'm not sure I like that idea. It's a kind of sequential thing that we might talk about, but I think the wording, a secure base from which I can finally begin to even be aware of someone other than myself. And that secure base I'm suggesting is, oh, I'm finally experiencing my day-to-day life in a way that I find deeply fulfilling and satisfying, and it brings with it a positive sense of personal dignity. Now maybe I can begin to turn to you and be aware of you. I think it was Harry Overstreet who said, the immature person doesn't even see other people. His mind is too noisy in there to even be aware of, see, or hear other people.
Yeah, thank you. I think that could be complex, perhaps, but I agree that there's an important there to what you're saying. Love, as I'm suggesting it here, is an act of strength, and it is a kind of a discipline thing, which is the same root that our word disciple comes from. It's a strong thing. When I was back at the University of Rochester, I had a brilliant, wonderful and generous, but very earthy Jewish head of the Department of Religion and Classics. And he said, partly jokingly, but not entirely, you know what you Christians, talking to me, you know what you Christians mean by turn the other cheek? And then he turned around and patted his bum and he said, kick me again. In other words, that's Nietzsche's accusation against Christ and the Christian ethic, that it's an ethic of weakness, turn the other cheek, and all the soft virtues of grace and mercy and forgiveness,
as opposed to the
large manly virtues of courage and imagination and boldness, etc. But I think that misunderstands the whole point of Christ's kind of love and love unto death, that it's an act of courage and strength, and that requires in its mature form awareness and groundedness and the capacity to have a self so you can give of self for another self's growth. So I think you're on to something important with that thought.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.